Court will hear arguments first this morning in Bowers against Hardwick. Mr. Hobbs, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the question of whether or not there is a fundamental right under the Constitution of the United States to engage in consensual, private, homosexual sodomy. In 1982, Michael Hardwick was arrested and charged with a violation of Georgia's anti-sodomy statute for engaging in this conduct with a consenting adult in his home. The case was never presented to the grand jury of Fulton County, and no prosecution of Mr. Hardwick ensued. However, in 1983, Mr. Hardwick, along with John and Mary Doe, filed a Section 1983 suit seeking injunctive relief and declaratory relief against the enforcement of Georgia's sodomy statute.
Was there a reason, Mr. Hobbs, that it wasn't presented to the grand jury?
Your Honor, the district attorney of Fulton County, who would have handled that case...
That's Atlanta, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. Indicated that it would not be presented to the grand jury until further evidence developed. That is the only reason that I know that it was not presented.
Mr. Hobbs,
yes, Your Honor.
Is the statute enforced in Georgia?
Yes, Your Honor, the statute is enforced in Georgia.
How many prosecutions have there been in the last year or 5 years?
I could not tell the court that. I could only say that in our experience, the statute is most frequently enforced in situations where the conduct takes place in more public or quasi-public areas.
Well, I should have framed my question more specifically in the context of the issue presented in this case where the activity took place in a private residence. Had it ever been enforced?
It had been enforced. I believe the last case that I can recall was back in the 1930s or 40s in the state of Georgia, appellate decision. Obviously, Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment impedes the ability of the state of Georgia to enforce the statute when the conduct takes place in the privacy of the home. Nevertheless, it is our position that the Fourth Amendment restrictions should not have any bearing on whether or not there is a fundamental right to engage in this conduct.
Did you say the last prosecution was in the 30s or 40s?
The last reported appellate decision concerning this type of conduct in a private setting.
Has it ever been enforced against him in the marital situation?
Not to my knowledge. Not in the state of Georgia, at least.
But on its face, the statute would permit such a prosecution, would it not?
That is correct, Your Honor. The statute does not differentiate between married individuals, unmarried heterosexuals, or homosexuals. It is our position that there is no fundamental right to engage in this conduct, and that the state of Georgia should not be required to show a compelling state interest to prohibit this conduct. There is certainly no textual support for this proposition, and contrary to the views expressed by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and the respondent, it is suggested that there is no precedential support in the decisions of this court for the proposition that there is a fundamental right to engage in sexual relationships outside of the bonds of marriage. This court, in the Carey decision in 1976, made it fairly explicit that its previous decisions relating to contraception and abortion were restricted to state regulations which burden an individual's choice to prevent conception or to terminate pregnancy. And the court concluded that it was not holding that a state must show a compelling state interest every time that sexual freedom is involved. In Moore v. City of East Cleveland, Justice Powell noted the difficulty that this court has sometimes had in defining fundamental rights under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and suggested, based upon numerous cases of this court, that appropriate limits and guidelines for determining whether or not rights are truly fundamental can be found in the tradition and history and heritage of this nation. In that particular case, Justice Powell, writing for plurality, concluded that the Constitution protects the family simply because the family is so rooted in the history and traditions of our nation. Many of this court's decisions have followed the history and traditions of our nation in making its determination as to whether or not a particular activity is entitled to constitutional protection as a fundamental right. Thus far, this court has concluded that the right of privacy includes matters which involve marriage, the family, procreation, abortion, child rearing, and child education. It has never concluded, and I would suggest to the court that there is no constitutional warrant to conclude that there should be a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy or any other type of extramarital sexual relationships. The common thread of this court's...
May I just ask, what is your position on the application of the statute to a married couple?
Your Honor, please.
Could it be constitutionally applied or not?
I believe, in light of Griswold versus Connecticut, that application of the statute to a marital, to a married couple would make it very problematic in the state of Georgia.
Well, do you think they could or could not? Do you think it would be constitutional or unconstitutional to apply it to a married couple?
I believe that it would be unconstitutional.
You think it would be unconstitutional? And what is the right that would be protected of the married person in that situation, in your view?
The right of marital privacy is identified by the court in Griswold.
And this conduct, though it's traditionally frowned upon, as I understand your brief, you say would nevertheless be constitutionally protected in the marital setting.
Yes, Your Honor. Based upon this court's finding in Griswold versus Connecticut, in which Justice Douglas stated the right of marital intimacy is older than our Bill of Rights. It harkened back to the heritage
of this
nation.
Yes, but he didn't say anything about this kind of conduct.
That's correct, Your Honor. The court has previously described fundamental rights, whether they be under the general heading of a right of privacy or other fundamental rights, as those which are so rooted in the conscience of our people as to be truly fundamental. Principles of liberty and justice which lie at the base of our civil and political institutions. Privileges which have long been recognized at common law as essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. The simple fact is that homosexual sodomy, which is what is involved in this case, has never in our heritage held a place.
Is the record clear as to that, as to whether the conduct was with a male or a female?
The record, I believe, Your Honor, the complaint indicated that Mr. Hardwick was arrested for engaging in a sodomitic act with another male. Our legal history...
Well, of course, this isn't a review of any conviction, is it? The only reason you would want to show that is to show there was a danger of prosecution.
That is correct, Your Honor. This is a review of a dismissal of a Section 1983 lawsuit. And under that dismissal, we are bound by the allegations contained in the complaint. Our legal history and our social traditions have condemned this conduct uniformly for hundreds and hundreds of years. As late as 1979, in the Parham versus Hughes case, this court indicated that it is neither illogical nor unjust for society to express its condemnation of irresponsible liaisons outside of the bonds of marriage. I would submit to the court that the respondent and the 11th Circuit have pose no reasons to distinguish the rationale of that decision. Nor should the conduct be considered fundamental, protected by the Constitution, merely because it might take place in the home. The 11th Circuit and the respondents rely heavily upon this decision in Peyton versus New York and in Stanley versus Georgia. Of course, Peyton was a Fourth Amendment case involving the physical intrusion of individual of the state into a person's home. This is not a Fourth Amendment case. The Fourth Amendment does not, while it does provide a general right of privacy concerning the home, it does not prevent the state from enacting regulations which govern activities in the home.
It might well, as a practical matter, I suppose, prevent the state from enforcing its law with respect to the home. But your point is that that doesn't make the law invalid.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. The Fourth Amendment, as this Court has held, protects two types of expectations, searches and seizures. And those expectations are not involved in the questions presented to the Court today. Stanley versus Georgia, which is relied on most heavily by the respondent, is also, I would submit, inapplicable to this situation. For in Stanley, this Court found that there was an underlying right, a fundamental right under the First Amendment, to freedom to receive information and ideas. And it was that right which was being infringed upon when Georgia attempted to prosecute Mr. Stanley for the private possession of pornographic material. This case does not involve any such underlying right. In order for Stanley to be applicable, I would submit to the Court, this Court must find first that there is a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy. Moreover, Stanley has been limited to its facts by this Court in United States versus 200-foot reels of film, wherein this Court decided that Stanley was a line of demarcation, that the Court would go thus far but not beyond, and limited Stanley strictly to the facts of that particular case. Conceitedly, there are certain kinds of highly personal relationships which are entitled to heightened sanctuary from state intrusion. The respondents would urge, and the 11th Circuit has concluded, that the relationship involved in this case is entitled to constitutional protection as a fundamental right under the right of intimate association. Only a limited number of associations and relationships have been found by this Court to be entitled to constitutional protection. Those that attend marriage, the family, raising children, and cohabitation with one's relatives. This Court has described those relationships as personal bonds, which have played a critical role in the culture and traditions of the nation by cultivating and transmitting shared ideals and beliefs.
Mr. Hobbs, when you say cohabitation with one's relatives, you mean living in the same house with them?
That is correct, Your Honor. I was referring, of course, to this Court's decision in Moore versus East Cleveland. This description, I would submit to the Court, does not apply to the conduct which is prescribed by Georgia's sodomy statute. Respondent and some amici in this case have argued that perhaps the definition of the family should be changed so as to be extended to homosexuals and other types of relationships which have not been recognized in our society thus far, so as to accommodate the conduct which is prohibited and elevate it to a constitutional status.
General Hobbs, can I ask you one question that's prompted by Justice Rehnquist's notion that there are difficulties of enforcement within the home? And earlier you've been asked about the extent to which the statute's been enforced. In this case, as I read the complaint, the plaintiff expressly alleged that he did this sort of thing over and over again. And I take it the state didn't take discovery to find out maybe they could prove that that was in fact true and therefore could have prosecuted him. How do you reconcile that with the notion that there is a statute that the state seeks to enforce in a situation that he says exists in this case?
Well, Your Honor, to be quite frank, I do not know what was in the mind of the district attorney when he decided not to prosecute this case.
But what about the state representative who defended this very lawsuit?
In terms of prosecuting Mr. Hardwick?
If they thought there was an important public interest in enforcing this statute, why wouldn't they take his discovery, get him to admit he'd committed all these acts, and then prosecute him?
Because at the time, Your Honor, we relied heavily, almost exclusively, on this court's decision in Doe versus Commonwealth's attorney. The state of Georgia was in this case by virtue of the declaratory judgment action, and it was decided that a motion to dismiss the 1983 lawsuit should be filed based upon this court's decision in Doe versus Commonwealth's attorney.
Well, I can understand why that would win the lawsuit for you, but I find it puzzling as to how that vindicates the public interest that the statute was supposed to serve to stop this kind of conduct.
Well, I think...
Does the state really have an interest in stopping this kind of conduct? And if not, why wouldn't they enforce the statute?
I think that most certainly the state does have an interest in enforcing the statute and in maintaining the statute on our books. As I've indicated, the Fourth Amendment makes the enforcement of the statute very difficult. But the statute also...
It would have been very easy in this case, this individual.
Perhaps
presented
so.
With a silver platter, and they declined to go forward.
Well,
it seems to me there's some tension between the obvious ability to convict this gentleman and the supposed interest in general enforcement.
I would agree, Your Honor. We are, however, bound by the record as it is presented to the court, and I am wary of going beyond the record to explain other evidence. The respondent, as I was saying, was, and some of Michi have urged that the relationship of the family should be redefined. And this is one of the interests that the state of Georgia is most concerned about. We are very concerned that there is a potential, should the 11th Circuit's decision be upheld, for a reshuffling of our society, for a reordering of our society. As this court indicated in Roe versus Wade, the right of privacy is not limited. It is not absolute, pardon me. There must be limits, and it is submitted that in finding these limits, we must be wary of creating a regime in the name of a constitutional right, which is little more than one of self-gratification and indulgence. The Constitution must remain a charter of tolerance for individual liberty. We have no quarrel with that. But it must not become an instrument for a change in the social order. The plaintiffs, the respondents, have made a crack-in-the-door argument that if the 11th Circuit's decision is affirmed in this case, it will not go beyond consensual private homosexual sodomy. But it is submitted that this crack-in-the-door argument is truly a Pandora's box. For I believe that if the 11th Circuit's decision is affirmed, that this court will quite soon be confronted with questions concerning the legitimacy of statutes which prohibit polygamy, homosexual same-sex marriage, consensual incest, prostitution, fornication, adultery, and possibly even the personal possession in private of illegal drugs. Moral issues and social issues, it is submitted to the court, should be decided by the people of this nation. Laws which are written concerning those issues are rescinded concerning those issues should be by the representatives of those people. otherwise the natural order of the public debate and the formulation of consensus concerning these issues, it is submitted, would be interrupted and misshapen. There is a right of the nation and of the states to maintain a decent society, representing the collective moral aspirations of the people. The 11th Circuit and the respondents in this case, by failing to adhere to the traditions, the history of this nation, and the collective conscience of our people, would remove from this area of legitimate state concern a most important function of government, and possibly make each individual a law unto himself. It is submitted to this court that this is not the balance that our forefathers intended between individual liberties and legitimate state legislative prerogatives. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Tryon.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is about the limits of governmental power. The power that the state of Georgia invoked to arrest Michael Hardwick in the bedroom of his own home is not a power to preserve public decorum. It is not a power to protect children in public or in private. It is not a power to control commerce or to outlaw the infliction of physical harm or to forbid a breach in a state-sanctioned relationship, such as marriage, or indeed to regulate the terms of a state-sanctioned relationship through laws against polygamy or bigamy or incest. The power invoked here, and I think we must be clear about it, is the power to dictate in the most intimate and indeed, I must say, embarrassing detail, how every adult, married or unmarried, in every bedroom in Georgia will behave in the closest and most intimate personal association with another adult.
Mr. Professor Tribe, is there a limiting principle to your argument? You responded, you commented, but I don't think responded to the suggestion that how do you draw the line between bigamy involving private homes or incest or prostitution? And you move on to the place. You emphasize the home, and so would I if I were arguing this case. But what about, to take an easy one, a motel room or the back of an automobile or a toilet or wherever? Well, what are the limiting principles?
Justice Powell, I think there are two kinds of limiting principles. The first relates to the place. This court's the place where the acts occur. In Stanley versus Georgia, this court suggested that the mere possession and enjoyment of obscenity at home is quite different from other supposedly private places. And in the Fourth Amendment area, the court has faced the problem of defining what is a home. It said that, for example, a mobile home may not qualify. We think that wherever that line is drawn, that a private home such as this represents the repository of constitutional traditions under the Third and Fourth Amendment.
And what about incest in a private home?
Right. It seems to us that the private home does not shield anything that one might do there. It seems to us that the state's power to regulate the terms of relationships, just as it regulates the terms of contracts, includes the power to punish a breach of contract in a home. It can certainly punish adultery wherever it occurs without invoking its
private. So the limiting principle is limited to sodomy. Is that a principle?
No, not quite. I think it's somewhat broader, to be candid, Justice Powell. I think it includes all physical, sexual intimacies of a kind that are not demonstrably physically harmful, that are consensual and non-commercial in the privacy of the home. Indeed, Mr. Hobbs said that under his theory, the state should be able, without providing a compelling justification, to punish, his words were, irresponsible liaisons outside the bonds of marriage. So imagine for a moment an ordinance or statute that says unmarried couples may hold hands and they may perhaps embrace lightly. But extended caresses or kissing with the mouth is forbidden. Now, in their theory, even if this occurs in the home, under their theory, as long as the state says a majority of our legislators disapprove of this conduct, and indeed there's a long history of disapproving things that might lead to greater intimacies among unmarried people, we can outlaw it, not just outlaw it, but we can resist a request for a more particularized explanation of why. When Justice Stevens asked, what is the public interest, after all? Why is it so great if you don't even want to prosecute in this clear case of violation? I think you noticed that Mr. Hobbs retreated to generalities. What we suggest is that when the state asserts the power to dictate the details of intimacies in what they call irresponsible liaisons, even in the privacy of the home, that it has a burden to justify its law through some form of heightened scrutiny. In your concurring opinion, Justice Powell, in Kelly versus Johnson, when you suggested that a regulation on the length of hair, if applied across the board to all citizens, unlike that case, which was just the police, would involve an important personal liberty interest, would require a balancing of the state interest against the personal interest, and cited the Harlan dissent in Poe v. Ullman, I think that what you recognized in that case, and what I would stress here, is that when a state's assertion of power over liberty occurs at the intersection of intimate personal association, which this Court has recognized in a half century of cases, and the privacy of the home in the clearest possible sense, that then there must be at least heightened scrutiny rather than the kind of unquestioning deference that the state of Georgia would request.
Well, you're not sure that you have answered Justice Powell's question about incest and privacy.
Yes. Mr. Chief Justice, as to incest, it seems to me quite apart from problems about offspring and whatever genetic evidence there might be, that the state's power to define the terms of relationships and to limit potential exploitation surely includes the power in the employer-employee context to say that the parent consent to sex is not real, in the parent-child context to say that a parent consent is not real. So we don't think there is such a thing.
It's parent and adult child. Those are two consenting adults then, perhaps.
I doubt, Mr. Chief Justice, that the state would have to assume that just because a woman is over 21, that if her father induces her to have sex, that that's got to be consensual. We think a state can assume that there are certain relationships in the context of which, even if both people are adults, in the context of which consent, because of the power structure of the relationship, may just be an illusion. But there's nothing about this law that limits it to cases where consent is questionable, or where there is some other relationship between the parties that makes this other than completely consensual intimacy.
Mr. Tribe, your line of reasoning would make the Edmonds Act unconstitutional, would it not?
The Edmonds Act, Justice Rehnquist, so far as it...
The Morrill Act had forbade polygamy, and the Edmonds Act forbade cohabitation by one who was already married.
No, I think, Justice Rehnquist, that cohabitation by one already married could be punished by the state as a breach of a state-sanctioned relationship. If the state can punish inducement to breach of contract in other cases, if the state can say that when people have made a solemn bond, a bond of status as well as contract, that it cannot be broken, I would think that laws against cohabitation and bigamy, wherever practiced, at least raise a different and far more difficult question than that here. Because here, the state is not saying that Mr. Hardwick was violating some relationship. The complaint, indeed, says nothing about the relationship between Mr. Hardwick and the other person, male or female. It just says that because a majority of us disapprove morally of what it did, we have the power, we, the state of Georgia, have the power to punish it and make it a crime.
Well, Mr. Tribe, how do you propose that these other situations be analyzed? By some sort of heightened scrutiny as well? And are you suggesting that there's a more compelling state interest? Or what is it you're saying?
I think, Justice O'Connor, there are two approaches, either of which would lead to the same result. One is that the recognized power of the state to protect children and to protect relationships and to prevent harmful conduct is such that it would be pointless to require heightened scrutiny any more than this court does of the minimum wage laws or other laws regulating special relationships, and that therefore minimum rationality would suffice. The other approach would be to say that if it's in the privacy of the home, scrutiny should be somewhat heightened. But it seems to me that it would be very easy for the state to show a compelling justification and a compelling interest. And it seems to me that in either event, the holding of the 11th Circuit, which is that in cases of this kind, where a law reaches sweepingly to all consensual intimacies in the privacy of the home, without drawing any of the lines that a legislature might draw to deal with these problems.
Professor Tribe, let's come back to the privacy of the home and part of the question I asked you that I don't think I gave you an opportunity to answer. Would you distinguish the home between the back of an automobile?
Certainly, Justice Powell.
And a public toilet, of course.
Certainly. We would say that in Onofre, for instance...
What about a hotel home overnight?
We would think that a hotel room overnight is not entitled to the same degree of protection, but frankly, I do not know precisely where the line would be drawn. For Fourth Amendment purposes, a hotel room overnight gets full protection. But when this court decided in Peyton that one needs a warrant to enter a private home, even with probable cause, it's not clear to me that that decision, which reflected, as your concurring opinion in Rakus did, the sense that there's something special about a home, would automatically extend to a hotel room.
I mentioned something special about a home in Moore also, against East Cleveland. You mentioned Poe against Ullman, but didn't Justice Harlan, in his dissenting opinion, exclude sodomy when he was talking about the history of relationships?
Justice Powell, I have been troubled by the parts of the Harlan dissent in Moore, which rather casually mentioned homosexuality and, for that matter, abortion in much the same breath. The actual language that I think is operative at page 552 of the Harlan dissent is that he would not suggest, he says, that adultery, homosexuality, fornication, and incest are immune from criminal inquiry, however privately practiced. And we're not arguing for absolute immunity. We're arguing for heightened scrutiny. That is, the 11th Circuit only held that when a law of this kind is challenged because of its intrusive invasion of personal liberty at the intersection of intimate association on the one hand and the privacy of the home on the other, the state must do more than appeal to the tautology that a majority of its legislators
disapprove. Mr. Tribe, can I ask you a little more about your second limiting principle? Your first is the place. The second, as I understand it, is that if the justification is to protect some state-sanctioned relationship, it may be permissible. Would it be permissible, in your view, for the state to prohibit heterosexual conduct between males and females who are not married to one another and not married to anybody else, in order to discourage that conduct and sort of foster the marriage institution?
I would think, Justice Stevens, first, that if they did that, strict or substantially heightened scrutiny would be required. Second, I think that when the state makes the argument that it's necessary to illegalize extramarital, completely non-marital sexual relations in order to put marriage on a pedestal, that under heightened scrutiny, that argument would emerge as rather dubious, the cause-effect relationship extremely dubious, as in Kerry and as in Griswold, when the argument was, we want to outlaw contraceptives because indirectly that will make...
What you're saying is that would implicate your second limiting principle but not carry the day.
Exactly, Justice Stevens.
But would you say there is a parallel between that problem and the one we have before us today?
I would say that in the one we have...
One could argue that the reason for discouraging it is to encourage marriage.
If that argument were made on remand, that is, if the court were to agree that heightened scrutiny is appropriate, it would certainly be a legitimate argument for the state to advance, unlike the tautology it advances here. We outlaw it because we don't like it. We think it's immoral. It would be a legitimate argument that this is a properly tailored means of encouraging marriage. I would then submit that one would have responses along the lines of Bodie v. Connecticut, the right not to be married. It would then be a more finely tuned inquiry into whether the state's intrusion into so personal and intimate and private a realm was really a rationally, reasonably tailored means of achieving that end. And I frankly doubt that it could be sustained. But at least the state would not be asking for the utterly opaque and unquestioned deference that it seeks in a case of this kind, where it says that because a majority for a long time have disapproved this conduct, we can make it a crime. If history alone were the guide, that is, surely I have to concede that the framers of the 14th Amendment, and perhaps Justice Harlan, 25 years ago, would have been prepared to assume that the kinds of sexual intimacies involved in this case would be outlawed. But then the framers of the 14th Amendment assumed that the kinds of sex roles given constitutional protection in Reed v. Reed and in Frontiero and in Stanton v. Stanton and in Hogan v. Mississippi University for Women also could be outlawed. The law that they assumed would apply is the law that kept Myra Bradwell from being a lawyer. But as this court recognized in Loving against Virginia, where also a majority of the people of Virginia believed that interracial liaisons were inherently immoral, and where for a long time a lot of people had believed that, this court did not think that the Constitution's mission was to freeze that historical vision into place. Justice Harlan's dissenting opinion in Poe v. Omer recognized the evolutionary character of the definition of those intimacies that are protected. And it seems to me that it would hardly be a suitable role for any court to decide its own catalog of protected intimacies.
Well, Mr. Tribe, if this evolution is taking place, as you suggest, and you may well be right, why isn't it more proper for this court to let it be reflected in the majority rule where, you know, states have repealed these statutes?
Justice Rehnquist, we do think that that trend is at least relevant to the question of whether this is self-evidently evil. But this court has never before held that when a personal right is protected by the Constitution, just because those persons might be able to obtain political redress, the right no longer deserves judicial protection. Indeed, in Justice Powell's dissent in Garcia, the suggestion was made that surely this court would never say, as to individual rights, that the ability of individuals to possibly persuade a legislature to protect them is enough. That is, in Stanley v. Georgia, another case where Georgia wanted to impose its morality on the privacy of the home, the argument could also have been made most states have legalized possession of pornography.
But I thought your argument suggested that 25 years ago, at the time, if that's the right time, that Justice Harlan wrote his dissent in Poe against Ullman, perhaps these rights wouldn't, that you're arguing for here, the right to commit sodomy, would not have been constitutionally protected. But now they are. What's happened in 25 years?
I do not think that if this case had been squarely presented before Justice Harlan, that he would have decided to draw the line based on which body parts come into contact. That is, I think he would have recognized that the power of the state, in a case properly presented, the power of the state to have its own catalog of how you can touch someone else in the privacy of the home is limited.
Well, then he just wrote that part of his dissent in a fit of absent-mindedness?
No, I don't think Justice Harlan was capable of fits of absent-mindedness. But this court's doctrine about advisory opinions recognizes that even the best justices are at their best when they have a genuine case or controversy before them. And I do think we have one here. That is, I want to make some comment about the suggestion implicit in some of the questions that the absence of frequent prosecutions in cases like this, apart from how strongly it suggests the state of Georgia hardly has a compelling or important interest in vindicating this law, might also provide an avenue for avoiding decision, much as the court found one in Poe versus Ullman. It does not seem to me that that avenue is a plausible one here for several reasons. After all, Mr. Hardwick was arrested. Under this very arrest, he could still be prosecuted. Under this arrest, he is subject to considerable restraint. And the state's undisputed resolve to enforce this law, at least in some instances, according to their own catalog of where they think it's appropriate to enforce it if evidence comes to their attention, that resolve is undiminished, especially since this is a facial attack on the law. It seems to us that the nature of the harm that Mr. Hardwick suffers from having been arrested and being told he's a criminal and might be arrested again makes it very difficult to avoid decision.
You say it's a facial attack, Mr. Trett. I had thought it was only as applied in the home.
Well, I suppose with every facial attack, Justice Rehnquist, there's some definition of the relevant universe. There's no suggestion, for instance, that the part of this law which involves aggravated sodomy is under attack. The argument, however, is that this law, in its sweeping definition of intimacies in the home, is unconstitutional, and that
you're saying when applied in the home. I thought your response to Justice Powell was that a hotel room, maybe a motel, backseat of a car, no.
No, that's correct. We don't rely on peculiarities of the facts here, but we do say that it is only in the context of the home that the very powerful confluence of rights represented by the home and intimacy are involved.
Well, then it's really not a facial attack on the statute, I don't think.
If you want to call it something else, that's not a problem. In any event, it's important, I think, to recognize that he is not identifying something about his situation relevantly different from that of a married couple that might be prosecuted, and saying that the law perhaps protects them, but not me, but I'm invoking their rights. That is, the argument he makes is that regulation of sexual intimacy in the privacy of the home by a law this sweeping is subject to heightened scrutiny. And there's no severability clause in this law, as there wasn't in Kerry or in Zablocki. This is not, for example, one of the five states that outlaws sodomy only between people of the same sex. So it seems to us that what is before the court, quite clearly, is the power of Georgia asserted through this statute to criminalize without explanation beyond the tautological invocation of the majority morality.
Professor, what provision in the Constitution do you rely on, or that we should rely on to strike down this thing?
The Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment, Justice White, as given further meaning and content by a course of decisions over half a century. We think as to the home that the Third and Fourth Amendments...
Which cases do you particularly rely on?
Well, we think with respect to the home dimension, we rely heavily on Stanley, where the idea that it was a First Amendment right surely will not wash, because, as this Court later held, indeed in the very case they cite, 200-foot reels, there's no right to buy the material, no right to sell it, no right to show it to consenting adults in public, only a right to enjoy it in private. With respect to the intimacy dimension, we rely heavily on Griswold and on Eisenstadt to show that Griswold cannot be limited to married couples. And with respect to both, we rely on the fundamental principle recognized in the concurring opinion in Kelly v. Johnson that important intrusions upon liberty are not to be upheld on a form of review so deferential that though it might be appropriate in regimented contexts such as the police or the military, this Court has never held it appropriate in dealing with all citizens in the privacy of their homes.
How do you articulate this right or this process of declaring a right? Do you say it's a fundamental right, or is it a... How do you go... How should we go about identifying some new right that should get protection?
Well, Justice White, I think the method that this Court used in both Griswold and in Roe of looking to tradition in terms of the protection of the place where an act occurs and of looking to a tradition in terms of recognizing autonomous personal control over intimacy is an appropriate process to employ. It seems to us that it's easier using that process to conclude that this case implicates a fundamental right than even to conclude it in Moore v. East Cleveland. Because important as the tradition of family is, in your dissenting opinion in Moore, I think it was an important point that it was not necessarily so crucial a matter for the society to assure the right of grandmothers to choose exactly which grandchildren to live with. Now, I think myself, the majority was right in that case. But whatever you think about Moore, the long line of opinions cannot in any principled way be cut off at the particular triangle of rights in which the state of Georgia would try to encase this Court's precedents, marriage, family, and procreation. That is, if the entire line of decisions is not to be repudiated root and branch, it has to stand for some generalizable principle of the kind that the majority opinion in the J.C.'s case endorsed, where the Court expressly rejected the idea of a methodology that would proceed by specific categories unmentioned in the Constitution, like marriage and family, and in favor of a more functional approach that would look to the distinctively personal aspects of life that are being regulated in settings distinguished, as the court put it, by smallness, selectivity, and seclusion. Now, if liberty means anything in our Constitution, especially given the Ninth Amendment's proposition that it's not all expressly enumerated, if liberty means anything, it means that the power of government is limited in a way that requires an articulated rationale by government for an intrusion on freedom as personal as this. It is not a characteristic of governments devoted to liberty that they proclaim the unquestioned authority of Big Brother to dictate every detail of intimate life in the home. What sense would it make to say that the government cannot quarter its regiments in the home if it could regiment every detail of life in the home? What sense does it make to use the apparatus of the Fourth Amendment with the controversial exclusionary rule to protect the privacy of the home if the Constitution is insensitive to the substantive privacies of the life within the home? It seems to us that if the protections of the Third and Fourth Amendments are not to be reduced to arid and empty formalisms, that they have to reflect an underlying principle, a principle not unlike that which this Court recognized in decisions like Meyer and Pierce, and more recently in Moore v. East Cleveland. Those underlying principles, I think it's important to stress, do not place on a constitutional pedestal, as though receiving this Court's particular approval, the particular acts involved in a case like this. I think in that sense it's misleading to say that we are championing a fundamental right to commit a particular sexual act. We are saying that there is a fundamental right to restrict government's intimate regulation of the privacies of associational life in the home. The principle that we champion is a principle of limited government. It's not a principle of a special catalog of rights. Robert Frost once said that home is the place where when you go there, they have to take you in. I think constitutionally, home is the place where when the government would tell you in intimate detail what you must do there and how to behave there, they have to give you a better reason why than simply an invocation of the majority's morality, which tautologically would vindicate, without any scrutiny by this Court, literally every intimate regulation of everything one can do in the home. It doesn't denigrate the special place of family and parenthood and marriage in our society to recognize the principle of limited government. On the contrary, if there's something special and unique about parental authority, it's that we do not cede to Big Brother the same unquestioned deference that children are perhaps supposed to give to their parents. When the government would tell people in this much detail how to conduct their intimate lives, and doesn't apparently have even a good enough reason to keep Mr. Hardwick in something other than a limbo in which he could be prosecuted any time until August under this extraordinarily sweeping law, when it does that, it seems to us that it is fully respectful of history and tradition for the 11th Circuit to have said, you owe Mr. Hardwick a better reason, and you owe the people of the United States a better reason than simply unquestioned deference. And I think Justice Harlan, if the issue had been properly posed in Poe v. Ullman, which of course didn't involve this, would have recognized that requirement of meaningful justification. Even if you only call it rationality review, it's rationality review with meaningful content of the kind this Court recognized in the Cleveland case.
Mr. Tribe, I'm curious to know, you've referred to Justice White's opinion in Moore v. Cleveland. Do you think that opinion helps you or hurts you?
Oh, it certainly hurts more than it helps. I was suggesting, however, that even that opinion, there is room for some hope. Your opinion in Moore v. East Cleveland is considerably more hopeful, because in that opinion you talk about the meaning of private property, which is also involved in this case. What does it mean to say that one's home is a private place if every detail of what one does there can be regulated by the state because they think it's an irresponsible liaison? It seems to us that the very meaning of home is denigrated, if that can be done. And it seems to us that it is only a principle of limited government that makes it important to affirm the 11th Circuit's decision that heightened scrutiny is required in such a case.
Let me ask you one other question about Justice White's opinion, which seems to assume that a law that has some impact on liberty must have some utility or his exact language is, must have a purpose or utility.
That's right.
What is your understanding of the purpose or utility of the law at stake in this case?
My understanding is that Georgia refuses to tell us, other than to say that the acts involved, we say, are immoral. Three times they say they're the very definition of evil, although half the states have decriminalized them. They refuse to advance a purpose or a utility. It's in that respect that even the form of review endorsed by Justice White's dissent in Moore, which requires some meaningful explanation of how this law would function to advance the public welfare, why it wouldn't be counterproductive, why it wouldn't cause more contempt for law than respect for family, some explanation is required. And if one reverses the 11th Circuit decision and allows the flat and unexplained dismissal of the district court to stand, the message of that is the state need not offer any explanation, no utility, no function. It is enough to say, we passed it, that means most of us think it's wrong, and a lot of people have thought it was wrong for a long time, therefore, ask us no further questions.
Well, Mr. Tribe, under your analysis, what sort of explanation would be required? You've suggested that if the state were to assert its desire to promote traditional families instead of homosexual relationships would not suffice, in your view. And yet that's an articulated,
yes,
potentially.
Justice O'Connor.
Articulated reason. Perhaps the state would say its desire to deter the spread of a communicable disease or something of that,
yes,
sort. So what suffices?
Well, as to the first, if the state of Georgia were simply defending a... Might I finish this? The answer to this question, Mr. Chief Justice Martin? If the state of Georgia were defending its refusal to sanction homosexual marriage, there'd be a close connection between that and the first rationale. The connection, however, would be so weak between this sweeping law and the rationale of endorsing or helping marriage that I doubt that would work. As to avoiding the spread of communicable diseases, the American Public Health Association, page 27 of the amicus brief, makes clear they think that this law, laws like it, would be counterproductive to that end. But you don't even reach that issue until you have some kind of meaningful inquiry. Surely, if a narrowly tailored law could be shown necessary to protect the public health, that would be a compelling justification. But Georgia offers no such justification here. Limited government, we think, makes the 11th Circuit's decision correct. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Hobbs?
The state of Georgia is not acting as big brother in this particular case. It is adhering to centuries-old tradition and the conventional morality of its people. Certainly, it cannot invade the privacy of the home and regulate each intimate activity which takes place there. Each statute enacted by any state must be rationally related to a legitimate government purpose, and it is submitted most respectfully to Mr. Tribe that this statute is related to the legitimate purpose of maintaining a decent and moral society. It is inherently intertwined with the state's concern with the moral soundness of its people. Just a couple of comments. The state of Georgia in its official code does have a general severability statute in case that should bear on any issue before the court. Summary, the liberty that exists under our Constitution is not unrestrained. It is ordered liberty. It is not licentiousness. If the 11th Circuit's decision is affirmed in this case, the state of Georgia and other states will be impeded from making those distinctions between true liberty, ordered liberty, and licentiousness. Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.